order?
The first bill on the agenda today is Senate File 660, Senator Rotskoy. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here with Senate File 660. Minnesota has one regional jail system in the state, in Polk County and up in the Crookston area, and they are redoing their joint powers agreement. And one of the issues that's arisen is with a three-county regional jail system. If you have the language that a majority of the counties are needed to make changes or withdraw, that gives a veto power to one county. These three counties have worked out an agreement to make a change in their joint powers agreement, but they need this statutory change. And I'm here with Susan Mills, who can provide more information about the necessity for this change in their joint powers agreement.
Ms. Mills, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Susan Mills. I'm Executive Director at Tri-County Community Corrections for Norman, Polk, and Red Lake Counties.
Do you have anything you would like to share with the committee?
Just to let you know that we have, since 1976, operated as a regional jail between the three counties, managed by the three counties. Our concern for the three counties right now is that we are in the process of a large building project for our jail and a new joint powers agreement. We would like to have the language changed in the Regional Jails Act so it would allow the counties to decide in their joint powers agreement how withdrawal will occur.
Thank you, Ms. Mills. Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Mills and Senator Scully, would this mean that, you know, since you don't have the joint powers agreement written yet, would this mean that, you know, one county could, say, unilaterally pull out over the objection to the other two? Because that would not be allowed right now, but theoretically could be allowed under if this passes?
Yes, that there'd be there would be language to specify how that would occur. And the three counties would agree to that language in a joint powers agreement. The problem right now would be that any one county could prevent any of the three counties from withdrawing under the current language.
Ms. Mills, has a new joint powers agreement been negotiated?
We have language that we have adopted. However, until this is taken care of, that really cannot be enacted.
And under the language of the new joint powers agreement, what is the stipulation on how you withdraw from the cooperation in this regional jail system?
Well, the exact language has not been put together, but the intention is that the agreement would be for, in the joint powers agreement, would allow any of the counties to withdraw within a year's notice to the other counties after 7 years, after the first 7 years of the new joint powers agreement. And that is in regard to the cost of the new facility and the investment for the three counties.
And Ms. Mills, when is the new joint powers agreement supposed to go into effect?
Well, if we're able to make the change here in the language, if this occurs, then we would be looking at that this spring. And July of 2007 is what we'd be.
July of 2007.
Yes.
And so, in essence, we are just giving you permission then to negotiate the terms among the three counties on how they could withdraw from the joint powers agreement.
Yes, Senator, that's exactly right.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, one of the things that in my discussions with Ms. Mills that we think has happened, there might have been more regional jail systems in the state if this language had not been in place, because a number of counties were hesitant to involve themselves in these large regional jail systems. without the ability to have some more flexibility on how the arrangement is. Now, with this change, they can negotiate the majority vote in their to withdraw in their joint powers agreement. But in these three counties' cases, it is a limiting factor to finalizing their current joint powers agreement negotiations.
Senator Betzel. Just
perhaps, Senator Sikoy, Ms. Mills, you can, again, explain the rationale. If my county wanted to unilaterally pull out, it could not do so under current law. It would have to have the permission of the other counties, and there's probably reasons for that because they've all made certain investments and assumptions. Why would my county want to make it easier for somebody else to withdraw without the consent of the other counties? Why would we want them to do that?
Ms. Mills?
Senator, the understanding is that we are making a considerable investment in our new facility, and the counties would like to do that knowing that exactly by what method they could withdraw, not that any one of the other counties could prevent them from withdrawing. And I think that is actually the largest concern, that one county could prevent either of the other two from withdrawal under any circumstance.
And Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, presumably the withdrawing county has already left its money on the table. They've contributed to something, so they're going to lose something if they pull out for whatever reason.
Ms. Mills.
Senator, the new language would stipulate how that would go, and the three counties would agree to that and have to sign that joint powers agreement together. So they would have already negotiated with all of the partners how withdrawal would occur and under what circumstances and what dollars, if any, would be affected.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You kind of lost me on what the purpose of this is and why couldn't you continue on with the other two counties and tell us what went wrong. I mean, it's obvious that when this legislation was passed is that there was an effort made to make sure that someone didn't commit to something and then find out that now you're leaving two counties with the jail there. Is that going to cost money? Or are they going to be looking to the state to bail them out?
Senator Foley? I think the situation here is that these counties have been involved in the joint powers agreement that is coming up for renewal. You know, this passed the Judiciary Committee last year, and it passed off the Senate floor last year. And I think their joint powers agreement is coming up for renewal. And I think the members of this joint powers agreement, because they're contemplating the creation of a new jail, would like to just ask us to give them permission to negotiate the terms of into the contract, the terms or the conditions of a possible withdrawal from the joint powers agreement. So I don't think this is going to create any imbalances. I think what they're just asking us to do is to give them permission to negotiate the terms and conditions and for us not to state it in statute. But Senator Skoy, if you would like to add to that.
Madam Chair, you are right. And from my perspective, if there is a withdrawal by a county, there would be some financial negatives to that county. But this change provides the counties some degree of independence when they're negotiating their joint powers agreement with regard to their withdrawal. I don't think it is any indication that there will be a withdrawal or whether there would be not, but it makes it a degree of independence in their thoughts as they negotiate the joint powers agreement.
Does that help to clarify your concerns, Senator Foley?
No, I really don't understand why negotiate an agreement and then are apparently constructing a jail. And knowing full well that there were limitations on what you could do there. I mean, if you have no immediate need, why are you here at this time, I guess?
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, because they're in the process of renegotiating their joint powers agreement, and they would like, the county boards would like to have some knowledge that there wouldn't be the ability of one county to have a veto, because if you have only three counties in your joint powers agreement, one wants to withdraw. If one other county says, no, you're not withdrawing, you don't have a majority, and therefore you cannot withdraw. I think it's for a degree of independence for the county boards as they enter into their new joint powers agreement.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
I guess if I were convinced that there would be no obligation on the part of the state to pick up the costs of these things, why I could be more supportive of this. It seems to me that having that clause in the law put in there for a purpose, and obviously it must have been to prevent people from bailing out and leaving someone else holding the jail or whatever.
Senator
Ms. Mills.
Thank you. Senator, I think you're absolutely right. That's why the language was most likely put in. However, we have been in existence and working very well together since 1976. And what we're contemplating is a change that in terms of a new facility, and there is an investment by all three counties in that process. The intent is to have, as Senator Scully suggested, independence and their ability to negotiate what those terms will be among the three counties without having any one county be able to veto a decision of the other county to drop out, to agree ahead of time. And there is no anticipation at this point in time that anyone is going to be dropping out. As far as financial responsibility, there's no intent at all from our point of view for the state to be involved at all, and in fact we're actually requesting that there be less confinement by the state statute and the allowance to withdraw.
Ms. Mills, in this contemplated new joint powers agreement that the counties will be negotiating, you've shared with us a little bit that the under the negotiation will be perhaps a 1 year's notice, but you can only serve that 1 year's notice after the first 7 years of participation in the agreement. Are there other terms built in to protect the other two participants if, after 7 years, the one partner does choose to serve notice and decide to leave the joint powers?
Madam Chair, I would expect that would be part of the negotiation. However, we've not reached a final agreement at this point. All three counties, the two members from each of the three counties serve on our Regional Corrections Board, and their counties are all in agreement that they would request this change. I don't think there's concern that some other agreement will be developed and that any one county would be, so to speak, left holding the bag.
Well, Ms. Mills, I think that Senator Foley raises a good concern. And in that, if we do allow you to the ability to negotiate this joint powers agreement, that we hope in 7 years that either both remaining partners don't show up here saying our one partner under our contract left us and we still have some bonds to pay off in our county facility and we're asking for state contribution, because I think then Senator Foley would be really, really upset, and he would still be here in the committee. Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair and members, and of course I don't know what other legislators are going to do, but it is currently the county's responsibility to build and operate this jail, and my intent is that it would remain the county's responsibilities, whether it's two counties or three.
Very good. Any other questions for Senator Skoy or Ms. Mills? All right. Seeing none, is there any member in the audience who is here to testify either for or in opposition to this bill? Senator Limmer, you're not in the audience. But you may
participate. I just wanted to move the bill. is a member.
That's right. Go ahead.
Let's see, what is the bill number?
660.
I'd like to move Senate file number 660. Is there any reference to finance committees at all?
No.
Go directly to the floor. Recommend to pass.
Senator Lindman has moved that Senate file 660 be recommended to pass and go on to the floor.
Tennessee.
Any further discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Next on our agenda is Senate File 624, Senator Betzel.
I take the clips off so they can see this. Okay. I'm a little pain.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 624 is a technical bill, or most of it's technical, dealing with marriage licenses. And I'll just briefly go through the bill, and I've got some witnesses who are here to testify on any section that members wish to discuss. Section 1 is simply a technical part. It refers to the court administrator issuing marriage licenses to developmentally disabled persons. The term should be the local registrar, so this is just a technical change. Section 2 also is a correction of the technical change to insert local registrar. It does also talk about the fee that should the fee collected by the local registrar for a minister who is going to perform weddings to record the minister's credentials. Right now, there is no consistent statewide fee. And it just happens to vary from county to county. Some counties charge zero. Some counties charge as much as $47. There is nothing in statute or anywhere that says it, so it's really up to the county. So this sets a statewide standard as to what the fee ought to be. And I don't think there's any expectation to raise money here. It's just to have it consistent through the state and actually pay for the service in recording the license. Section 3 is more of a clarification that says that if somebody takes out a license, marriage license, in Minnesota, then it should the wedding should actually take place in Minnesota. There's some confusion because, especially in our border counties that border on the other states, theoretically you could take out a license in Minnesota and then cross the border into the other state and get married. And it's always been understood that the license only applies to Minnesota, but we want to make sure that the people who get their license don't bring it to some other state. Section 4, I've got an amendment for. I'll describe what's in here, and then I'll if the amendment could be distributed. We have some laws on the books basically with felony convictions limiting how you can change your name and processes you need to go through. One loophole happens to be the marriage form where you can change your license. Now, the law does say that if you have a felony conviction, you may not use marriage to do it. However, there's a sneaky way you can get around it. Somebody named Jane Doe could change her name to Samantha Doe and effectively change her name without, even though this person's a felon. And so this is a little bit inconsistent with the other laws. Now, the way that it's worded here is probably not exactly the right way to do it, but there is an A1 amendment that would deal with that. And
Senator Betzel?
And I'd like to move the A1 amendment then.
Why don't we pass out the A1 amendment, and then you can explain to us
okay.
what that does.
I'm sure it's here in the packet.
It is an author's amendment, and I'm just trying to get a copy of it. And so we will amend it to the language so Senator Betzel can explain it to us. Because it's an author's amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion passes. Now Senator Betzel.
And the amendment just further clarifies the language that I described in Section 4. In Section 5, these deal with fees, and I'll have the witnesses help explain them, but basically the county's share of the fees don't quite pay for what they're supposed to do, but Section 5 and Section 6 kind of go together because it describes how much of the county fee is to be retained. It's currently $15. It's going to be proposed to be raised to $25 in Section 6. But and I'll have the witnesses further explain. There's a in law right now, there's an opportunity to get a reduced fee if you complete 12 hours of premarital education, but it doesn't specify that you need to complete that and show that you've completed it at the time that you apply for the marriage license. So actually somebody can pay the fee for the marriage license, come back at a later date after they've already done the premarital education and say, oh, by the way, I know I paid you the full fee before. Now I want a reduced fee. That causes a bit of confusion. This would basically say that they would have to apply at the time that they apply for the license, they'd have to show that they had completed the premarital education. Madam Chair, in just a moment, I will ask the witnesses to just describe the fee issue because that ties into both Section 5 and Section 6, and they can explain why that needs to be done. In Section 7, this just strikes the requirement that there be three certificates of marriage certificate. That isn't really needed anymore. Actually, when this law was originally passed, and this law dates back to the I think 1949, at a point in time, a man and a woman might need a copy of their marriage certificate in order to check into a hotel just to show that they were actually married. And, of course, that's not the situation anymore, so there really isn't a need for three certificates. But, again, we're dealing with kind of an old law that's on the books. And finally, Section 8 is just consistent language, and it's also saying that information solemnizing the marriage would actually be filed with the registrar, not delivered to. So that's just more of a legal requirement. Madam Chair, with your permission, I just have the witnesses here identify themselves and discuss the fee issues that are in Sections 5 and Section 6, because that obviously is a monetary issue, and they can explain why they're looking for that.
Please welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record.
I'm Cheryl Parrish. I'm the Todd County Recorder, but today I'm here representing the local registrars for the state.
And Madam Chair, I'm Susan Anderson with Anoka County. I'm also here as local registrars representing the state.
And so, Ms. Parrish or Ms. Anderson, which of you would like to speak on the fee issue?
The last time that the prior to 1949, the marriage license cost $2. And it consecutively went up. It was all county funds. In 1978 was the last time it was raised to $15, still all county funds. Then in 1981, it was raised to $30, the license was, $15 being the county portion and $15 being state funds. As of today, the marriage license is $100 for a full fee, $15 of that being the county portion yet, and $85 of that being state funds. On a reduced marriage, which is $30, $15 of it is county funds, and $15 of it is state funds. So what we're saying is the county portion has not been raised since 1978, and presently, taking a medium-sized county, we averaged it out, and for the cost of a license, it comes up to approximately $25.25. We took into consideration staff time, software, supplies, and everything, and so that's what we came up with, was an average of $25.25. And presently, we're only receiving $15 to do that.
Ms. Anderson, did you have anything to add, or?
No.
Questions for the witnesses, members. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzold, you opened your comments with a reference that a Minnesota marriage license or a certificate to marry was intended to be used within the confines of the state borders of the state of Minnesota. But what would it harm? What is there any harm if it was allowed to be done outside of the state? Is there some legal requisite in other states or Is it just a fee collection that we're really talking about? I'm thinking of maybe some exotic location where the couple wants to get married in Bahama Islands or something, and they want to bring their pastor along to officiate at that place. Why are we restraining ourselves as students?
This parish.
Madam Chair and Senator, there's a couple instances is what we're running into. On one of the bordering counties with North Dakota, the couple received their marriage license in Minnesota. They purchased their marriage license in Minnesota. They went to North Dakota and got married. There was a warrant out for the individual, and it got to be a border fight as to whether they actually could be married. And so that's one of the factors is, you know, they got married in North Dakota but got the license in Minnesota. So which is the power to be in that reference? The other item that we run into is people do leave the state of Minnesota, go and get married in the Bahamas or in Germany or wherever, and they want to bring their certificate back and file it with the local registrars. The local registrars presently are saying, we cannot take those because we did not issue the license to you, and we do not have control of that license. And so by making a certified copy of the license, we are saying it's a true and correct copy of what was in our offices, but we're also saying we were the custodian of those records. We issued you the license, we're holding the license, and now we're certifying to them. If we, you know, don't require it to be a Minnesota license and be used in Minnesota, we feel that it's opening it up to a lot of problems. And so we did get, in the reference to the North Dakota, Minnesota situation, that local registrar went to the Attorney General's office and asked for an opinion. We didn't receive a written opinion, but in his verbal opinion to the local registrar, he said it makes sense that it's a Minnesota license and Minnesota can only rule what happens in Minnesota, but the actual statute does not say that. And so they weren't able to help the situation out because it wasn't clearly defined as a Minnesota license. So our bordering counties are dealing with this every once in a while, and they've asked us to please address the issue.
Ms. Parrish, under current law, if you want to be married in Minnesota, you have to have a marriage license from the state of Minnesota, correct?
What the statute says is in order to be married in Minnesota, you must have a license. It doesn't say a Minnesota license.
So, Ms. Parrish, if somebody took out a license in Wisconsin and came to St. Paul and had their wedding performed here in St. Paul, and they wanted to register that marriage here in St. Paul, you're saying that that marriage license would not be accepted for registration here in St. Paul because the license was not issued here in Minnesota, correct?
Madam Chair, it depends on whether we pass this bill.
Under current law. Under current law, Ms. Parrish.
Madam Chair, that's true. We do not, because it's a, for instance, an example would be a carbon, okay? The marriage license is issued, and then it's torn apart, and that comes back to the original license. The marriage certificate comes back, ties into the original license. If it's not taken back to where it was performed, they would never show that the marriage was performed. We feel, local registrars, we don't have a way of filing those in our office because we never issued the license. So we are unable to file just the certificate.
So, Ms. Parrish, if a marriage license was issued in Ramsey County, I went off to the Bahamas and got married in the Bahamas, came back with that same marriage license signed and wanted to file in Ramsey County, will you file that marriage license?
That would be
Under current law,
that would be up to that county attorney as to whether that should be filed. In the instance of the North Dakota-Minnesota situation I told of before, the local registrar did file it because the original license was purchased in Minnesota, but then it got to be, was it actually a legal marriage because it wasn't performed in Minnesota?
So, Ms. Parrish, if this law passes, what we would be in essence saying is, if you want to get married in Minnesota, you need a marriage certificate that's issued, a license that's issued in Minnesota. And if you want to file a marriage certificate or a license, a marriage certificate in Minnesota, that license has to be issued by the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So from now on, you get the license here, you get married here, and you file it here, or we don't recognize it. Is that what the effect of this law is?
Well, we're not saying we don't recognize the marriage. All we're saying is we're unable to complete the paperwork in order to certify that you are married.
Senator Scheid.
Well, at least one question then. I mean, maybe you said this, but I'm listening hard. I really am. What about, Ms. Parrish, the person under current law who gets a license in Ramsey County and gets married in St. Louis County? How does the person in St. Louis, how does the registrar in St. Louis County know? I mean, they don't have a copy either, but under current law that could happen, right? What do you do now with that, where somebody does get married in state?
Ms. Parrish.
Madam Chair and Senator, presently, if they live in Ramsey County, easy for them to get their license, so they purchase it here, but then decide to go up in the harbor in St. Louis and get married. It's married. They get married up there. The person performing the marriage sends it back to the county of Ramsey, and then the process is finished.
Well,
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, couldn't that work for those people in the Bahamas? Wouldn't they know to come back with that certificate, or they probably have it? Wouldn't they be told?
Ms. Parrish.
It probably, Madam Chair and Senator, it probably could, but what we're saying is then we are forcing the other states and countries to acknowledge and go by our Minnesota rules. But if they didn't get married in Minnesota...
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'm just having a hard time telling people where they have to get married. I mean, I just don't, because we recognize the marriage. I don't know how, you know, nobody ever asked me to prove when I was married or that I'm not. But how can you enforce making them get married here? How do you get the word to the Bahamas that they may not marry those people with that Minnesota license?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, I don't think that there's no guarantee that the party going to the Bahamas or any other place outside of the state of Minnesota that it would only be legalized by the presentation of that document to to Ramsey County, if that were the case. And I don't see any concern for that issuance. It might not be spelled out as clear as it might, as the author might look at it and say, how can we get this so that the average person can read and understand it? But beyond that, I don't think there's anything.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I know there's a growing trend for people to want to go other places to get married. And I don't know how many other countries are honoring licenses at this point from Minnesota, or whether they have to go through a process to get a license in that country. I guess I just really don't know the answer to that. But for those people who are able to use a Minnesota license and then would bring it back here again and file it, are we going to make the process for them much more expensive and complicated?
They can't do it.
Would be one question I have. And then the second question I have would be, with Minnesota citizens, would we like to maybe keep some control over the rules that we have related to getting married And are we encouraging people not to have to follow those rules? I guess they could go somewhere else to get married if they want to anyway, but
Senator Olson and Senator Scheid, I think Ms. Pontius might be able to clear up some of our concerns here.
Oh, Madam Chair, members, sir. I think one thing to keep in mind is that sort of as a general rule, it's the law of the place where a marriage takes place that governs the validity of the marriage. So that's why Minnesota can only control marriages that occur within our state. Now, I don't know what would happen if somebody took a marriage license that was issued in Minnesota to the Bahamas and got married there. I'm not familiar with international marriages or anything, but I think they still have to go through some paperwork in the Bahamas, and then it's a question of getting it recognized here. In terms of other states, usually if a marriage is valid under the law of the state where it took place under the full faith and credit clause, then Minnesota will recognize that marriage. But the basic rule is that states control just what happens within their own boundaries as far as marriages. I don't know if that helps or not.
It does.
Thank you.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, if you have resolved that, I'd like to look at the fee business. I'm reluctant to make
good direction to go, Senator Foley. Good direction to go.
But I really think that we ought to take all those strikeouts and retain the current fees without increasing any of them. I'm talking essentially on pages 3 and 4 and various lines, line 23 on page 3 and line 4 19 on page 4, and also on 4.32 on page 4.
Senator Foley?
Yes.
I understand your intent. Would it be okay with you to please hold that thought, and let's hear from the witnesses the rationale behind the fee increases? I understand, one, they've been only getting the $15 since, I don't know, 1978. So they're here to say, you know, our costs have gone up, legitimately so, and we like our fees to go up. I think on their end of it, you know, I can understand. I think Senator Betzel is just here with a bill taking the notary fee from $1 up to
$5. 100%. This is much less, Madam Chair.
Senator Fee Betzold, I think that would become the new name here. So from the county's perspective, I think, I mean, they have a valid concern in that they have to cover expenses, although I understand where you're going with it. What I would like to do is I would like to, for example, in the $20 new fee for a minister's certificate, I'd like to hear the rationale for that. It is on page 2, line 1.
Oh.
Ms. Parrish or Ms. Anderson?
Madam Chair, I will try to explain the rationale. Past history, all of the local registrars were within the court administrator's office. As the state started taking those court administrator offices over, the counties wanted to retain the vital statistics. And so at that time, when that county's court administrators were moved to the state level, the counties found an office within the county to take over the local registrar. Now, some of those are in recorder's office, some in auditor's office, some in treasurer's office, some in license bureaus. So that kind of gives an idea of how it got into different offices. When the vital statistics came over to those offices, many of the fees were whatever was collected in the court administrator's office. That is what the local registrar collected. Thus comes the $5 filing fee. The $5 filing fee wasn't a specific fee, which was for the filing of ordinations or credentials. It was a miscellaneous fee under the court administrators, which said for any filing fee not addressed in statute, the filing fee shall be $5. So some counties didn't take that $5 fee because their court administrators didn't use that fee. Some counties did use the fee, and so they continued to charge the $5. Some counties felt it is not a statutory fee, filing fee. We do a process. We do work. It's time-consuming. And so they went to their county boards. And because it was a non-statutory fee, they passed a fee by resolution. So what we would like to do is to get a uniform fee that all 87 counties will charge, so that a person filing an ordination isn't going to be charged $46 in one county. In the next county, they would be charged $5. In the next county, they might be charged nothing. In the next county, it would be $10. Let's make it uniform. So then the discussion came to be, what should that fee be? We looked at the expense of filing, and basically it is very comparative to what we're doing on a notary issue. We're taking it in, we're filing it, we're indexing it, we're certifying to it, and so why can't we take that fee? The local registrars, with smiles on their faces, said, yes, $100 would be great. But no, don't look at the $100 because the county only gets $20 of that. So let's take that fee, which has been established for filing, indexing, and everything else, the same thing we're going to do with ordinations, and go with that same fee. So that's where the $20 fee came up. Justification, it would be a uniform fee throughout all 87 counties. It would pay for the cost of doing it. It would make it a statutory fee, and it would be comparative to what we're doing with notary commissions. I hope that explains how we got to where we're at.
Ms. Parrish, do we have any idea how much this money raises in the aggregate for counties?
Madam Chair, I did go back and contacted a few of the counties within our vital statistics committee. And in doing that, I'll give you a few of the counties. In Todd County, my county, last year I filed 6 ordinations. Martin County filed 4. Pipestone, 6. Faribault, 6. Wilkin, 3. And Crowing, 27. The fee that we're trying to establish, those that are of record already, are a one-time filing. And so those that are on record already are grandfathered in. What this fee would be is for anyone new coming to the state who wants to perform a marriage. In order to perform a marriage in the state, they need to file their credentials. They would pay their $20, and for the rest of their life, as long as their license permits it, they would be able to do marriages within the state. Do I think it's going to be a moneymaker? No, but it will pay for each filing of that certificate. So as you can see, each of the counties listed, Crowing County at $20 times 27, it would add up, but yet I think 27 is really high because most of the other counties, in talking with them, it's really a low number that is filed each year.
On the other hand, Ms. Parrish, if the number is this low, I guess if we didn't put this section into law, you wouldn't really miss it that much anyways, or would you?
Well, Madam Chair, if this section was not passed, the counties within the state would continue to charge whatever they wanted to charge. County commissioners who are looking for additional funds will say it's a non-statutory fee, so let's raise it. What we're trying to do is take that away and make it uniform throughout all 87 counties. Instead of 5 here, nothing there, 10 there, 46 there, is to make it a uniform fee.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any questions for Ms. Parrish on this $20 fee? Senator Foley, on this fee.
I haven't got any questions, but I applaud her for her efforts. When I look at the first item we have is a fee, and the last item we have is a fee, and the in-between are somewhat fees also. So just think about the need for some type
Senator
of a task force to go down.
Madam Chair, the Rules Committee is about ready to wrap up. I've got a bill before them. Maybe we could go to Senator Olsen's bill and let me go to Rules. I can come back and finish this bill. So.
Don, I'm a co-author. I can do that.
Senator Betzel, are you comfortable if we continue to ask?
Senator, Flanagan is a co-author of this bill, so maybe she could sit in the hot seat for a few minutes. But
are comfortable, we'll continue to ask questions. I'm sure this fee discussion will last long enough for you to get back.
I have to decimate it while you're going.
I'm sorry, Senator Foley, please continue your comments. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
What I'm looking for is this committee to develop some kind of a task force to look at fees overall. And it seems to me that the serious problems we have with increases and that it just defeats the purpose. I mean, basically, we're looking at the formalizing of marriage and the goal to have everybody get married if they're so inclined. And I guess this I like Senator Dill's his ideas about the foundation of marriage and the course that you have. But on the other hand, somewhere along the line, we have to stabilize that. And that's what I'd like to see happen here.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I think I'm probably the most recently married person around the table, strange as that may be. And let me tell you, the marriage license is one of the cheapest things that you'll buy at a marriage these days.
Well,
I'll second that.
You know, members, I think it Senate Counsel prepared this this one pager for us to look at with respect to the legislative history of marriage license fee. And I want to draw your attention to her section on the disposition of the fee, because I think that, yes, I agree with Senator Foley that it is of concern. We shouldn't make a fee to get married so onerous that it becomes a disincentive. But I think the county makes a valid point that they have been stuck with $15 since 1978. And the rest of the other fee, we've been bringing it back to the state coffers. And I think we need to look seriously at where the rest of the money goes. And, in fact, if we want to give them some relief, if that's what the desire of this committee is, but we also want to hold down the fees, I think we need to relook at the allocation of the rest of the other money. Ms. Pontius, can you walk us through this section?
Madam Chair, just the first part just shows the history of the fee amounts starting in 1969. And as you pointed out, to the $15 fee that the county still gets right now has been in effect since 1978. Starting in 1981 was when the special disposition began, and part of the fee started going to the state. And since that time, all of the increases in the fee have been captured by the state. Generally, to fund special programs, it's kind of gone back and forth over the years. Initially, it was used for battered women shelters and displaced homemaker programs. For a period of time, the special program funding was eliminated, and it just went back to the general fund. And then in 1995, it again was split up to fund just $5 at that point, went to Parenting Time Centers and then for the Minnesota Enable Program. When that $20 special fee was added in 2001 for parties who received premarital education, the county still got $15. So they've always just stayed flat at $15 out of every application. And to the extent that there was any reduction in funding, the state did bear that reduction at that time. And then in 2003, again, there was an increase which went for funding displaced homemakers. Again, they'd been out of the statute for a while. And then $5 was added to fund the Minnesota Healthy Marriage and Responsible Fatherhood Initiative. Then the last increase in 2005 was a $10 increase to both the general fee as well as a special one for parties who did the premarital education, and that was used for funding the displaced homemaker program.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, what do we know about the Minnesota Healthy Marriage and Responsible Fatherhood Initiative? It's not familiar at all to me.
Senator Dills.
Ms. Pontius,
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I'm not familiar with that particular program either. I know that Senator Dill did sponsor the legislation in 2001 dealing with the reduced fee for premarital education, and I think that might have been one of his projects as well, but it's not something that I was involved in. So I'm not, and I know it was also something that could receive some federal funding, which I think they did get, but I don't know if Mr. Turner has tracked any of that at all on the fiscal side.
I think that, members, there is I sense the concern in this committee for the amount of fees, and we have one more bill coming up with yet another fee increase going to the counties. I sense a concern with respect to the fee situation. We have one or two options. I think we could take the fee sections by section to see if members want to do something with the fee. I understand that this bill was supposed to go to the floor, but my sense is that all these fee increases, with all these fee increases, we should send it somewhere. And we could do that, because I think the policy, the non-fee policy items in this bill are worthwhile, and we should help the county out by getting it out of here. But I'm trying to come up with a good way to address the fee situation, and I'm open to discussion and input from members. Unless you're not concerned about the fee, and we could pass the whole thing on. Senator Limmer.
Well, Madam Chair, if I can refer you to page 3 on the premarital education. That was a recent legislative prerogative, I think, by Senator Dill. I believe that fee was established at that time. It certainly wasn't around in 1978. And I was just wondering why we would be raising that fee when premarital education is probably one of the more important policy considerations in light of a high divorce rate. I think we should probably keep that fee where it is rather than increase it for the premarital, at least, education, that is. I don't know what references that would be if it's on lines 14 and lines 23. I'm not sure. Now, where does that money go? I need to understand that a little bit better. Or that, is it defraying the cost somewhere else?
Senator Limmer, the... Now I know. I've been reminded that the reason why this doesn't need to go to any other committees is because the fee increase here doesn't impact the general fund. It goes directly to the counties. And so if we agree to this fee increase, the counties get the money and doesn't affect our budget. That's why it doesn't need to go to our finance committees. The $40 here is the reduced fee. So when they took the $100 to $110, that's a $10 addition to the $15 that they currently get. So they have to correspondingly go back and go and adjust, you know, the $30, of which they're only getting $15. So if they want to get the additional $10 from the $110, they have to increase the $30 by $10 to get the additional $10 when you get the reduced fee. Ms. Parrish, in that same section of the reduced fee for the premarital education, how do people know that they should go take a premarital class so that at the time when they come to take out their license, they can present that information and get the reduced fee? It would make sense to me that if I were to come to the county to apply for my license, then you hand me a note that says, oh, by the way, if you go take a class, you're eligible for a reduction. Then I could say, oh, all right, I'll go away for 6 months. I'll come back and get the reduced fee. But if somebody just comes to you and you say, you have to show us your certificate for now, are you engaging in some public education to let people know that they're eligible for this and they should get it ahead of time? Ms. Parrish.
Madam Chair. There basically are a couple ways of them finding out about this. If a marriage is performed through the church, Most of when the bill went into effect, all of the local registrars contacted their churches, notifying them of this change, sent them out a copy of the educator statement, which was created through statute, as to what the form had to look like and the specifics in the form that had to be completed. And at that time, they also educated the pastor or the priest or whoever it was to perform the marriage that the license would be $30 rather than the $100 should this educator statement be presented at the time of application. The other way that they can find out about it is many times when they're talking about marriage, the bride or groom will call to find out how much a marriage license is. And the local registrar at that time will say, a regular fee license is $100, but if you go through and have classes and bring in an educator statement at the time you make application, then the fee is $30. If they are not connected through a religious organization that is aware of this, then they ask us how they can get that, and we refer them to, you can, you know, and statute clearly defines who can give them the required hours of training. And then at that time, they decide whether they want to go that route or just pay the $100. So at the time that the bill first came out, I believe many of the local registrars did put something in the paper. But right now, that's the way that we handle it, is through the person performing the marriage, because they meet with them and go through the requirements of their religious church or whatever, or when they call the offices, they're notified.
Ms. Parrish, in your county, when somebody calls and says, I'm not affiliated or associated with a church, but I would like to the fee reduction, can you refer me to an organization that does this? Do you have a list of organizations that you refer people to?
We do not in Todd County, Madam Chair, but we tell them that there are classes, and we believe that I'm a Catholic, and I know that there were many people in attendance at our training, our 12-hour training sessions. Whether they were all Catholics or not, I'm not sure. And so that's what we also say is, in newspapers or different places, they do advertise when they have these educational classes. And so either through word of mouth or there's different ways that maybe they might be able to find them.
Well, Ms. Parrish, that's not reassuring to me. I mean, we're kind of offering people a false opportunity here. If even the county that gives out the license doesn't even have a list of resources for people to go to.
Madam Chair, I guess what we're looking at is by the time they come to us, it's usually 5 days before the marriage. Would they have time to have the 12-hour education? Probably not, but we do give them the opportunity. I don't know how else we could do it for them, because I don't know in Long Prairie, Minnesota, which is middle of the state, I don't know if there are any marriage counselors or therapy people, which the statute says can also provide.
All right, any other questions for Ms. Parrish or Ms. Anderson?
Oh.
Senator Limmer.
I don't get an opportunity to talk to people that are experts in this area in the legislature, but I had a pastor call me once, and he had a couple. Both were slightly mentally disabled, and they were described to me as being romantically inclined. and he also said that they also were eligible for medical assistance and general assistance. And he wanted to know if it was legal for him to provide what he would call a spiritual wedding, not a one that would be recognized by the state by certificate. He was concerned about the spiritual aspects of their romantic interests. And he wanted to know if, and I asked him, well, why wouldn't they get married with a certificate? And he said, well, their combined incomes would invalidate their general assistance benefits. And to tell you the truth, I didn't know what to tell him. as far as advice. And I doubt if I'll ever get this question again, but what would you have told them or this pastor to do?
Ms. Parrish?
We hear it all in the legislature.
Madam Chair and Senator, we have had where they go through just what is called a dedication ceremony through a church. Would the counties be able to certify to that? No. But it did, it did surpass the require or their feeling that they have some type of ceremony and that they were dedicated to each other. I hope that kind of answers your question. But yeah, the counties wouldn't get involved at that stage of the game, but that's what I would suggest to the people, that, you know, they possibly talk to their church, if they have a church, and see if there's some sort of dedication ceremony that could be performed.
Talk to the judge. I'm not an expert on this either, but I don't know if it matters if they're married or not. If they live together, if they're in the same household, don't they have to disclose that income for public assistance?
I don't know.
I'm not sure. I thought they did.
That was years ago, so I'm not going to go wake them up.
members, if you will look at page 4, line 17 through 35, is where we spell out the disposition of the now will be $110 fee. And in line 4.21 is a $50 into the general fund. If there's a desire, and then, you know, it lists some specific funds, and my inclination is that perhaps if we want to give some relief to the county but want to also address the increasing cost, I don't know if we necessarily want to mess with the other pots because we don't know much about what's going on in those areas, although I agree with Senator Foley that I think we're going to have to take a look at those other pots. You might want to think whether or not we want to do something with line 21.
On page four.
And Madam Chair, if we
Senator Olson,
if we did do something like that, then it would require referring this to another committee because then there would be an impact on the general fund, correct?
Yes, Senator Olson.
And if there's no appetite to do that, then, you know, it's the will of this committee. But understand that $110 is a lot of money to be paying for that. And we can definitely, Senator Foley, we're going to come back and look at all these different fees and where how these fees are being collected and where they're going and how effective those $2 or $5 are being used in those different pots. Yeah. So,
well, Madam Chair, I think that we all, or a good majority at least, want to have the marriage to take place, and to add burdens on there is not a thing that we need to do, in my mind.
Right. Senator Olson.
Well, I would, I haven't done this before, so ask for your indulgence, but I guess I would move then that the bill be amended on line 4.19 to continue to indicate that or to include the $25 going to the county, but to reduce on line 4.21 the $50 going to the general fund to $40 to the general fund, and then the line that showed the increase in the overall fee to $110 would be omitted so that the actual fee would stay at $100.
So, Senator Olson, the impact of your amendment would be that we would maintain the same amount, but we would take the $10 from the general fund disposition and give it to the counties.
There will be a number of places we'll have to change. Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, then just I think on page 3, yeah, line 14, I'm assuming you want to go back to the $100, so reinstate that, delete the 110. On line 23, reinstate the 30 and delete the 40. And then on page 4, on line 20, only $75. So you'd strike the 85 and insert 75 going to the state. That would coincide with the and then on line 21, strike the 50 and insert 40.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. That's Senator Olson's amendment. Any discussions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, yes. Can I ask Ms. Parrish how many, and also Ms. Anderson, how many of the how many marriage licenses do you sell in a year, for example?
Madam Chair and Senator, in Todd County, we average about 120 a year.
Statewide?
Madam Chair and Senator, in Anoka County, we average almost 2,000.
So, Madam Chair, and add 85 more counties worth. I mean, I think we're going to have some kind of an impact on state general fund. I think you ought to think about that since we all want to spend more.
We haven't included Hennepin or Ramsey.
Well, I know. And I think before, well, I mean, we can vote to do it. Obviously, it goes to finance for sure then. And, you know, they can get those numbers from the other counties. I'm thinking, I guess where I'm inclined to go with this, where my thinking is going is that the smaller number doesn't have as big an impact as all 87 counties, you know, collectively, and the impact of that money. You just have to weigh that. It's going to obviously have a different impact in different counties, but in some it's going to be very little money that may not make a difference. It may, however, make a difference in the state, and so and when it's all added up together, so I don't not inclined to support that.
And Madam Chair, I have no idea what the financial impact of this would be, but I assume it would be referred to then to another committee to make that determination.
Yep.
Whether that would be, you know, something that we could absorb in the general fund. But I am concerned about passing a bill that increases fees for people getting married in my district, but I do understand that we continue to place more burdens on the counties and don't give them the ability to make that up. So I don't know whether we can absorb that or not.
Senator Olson, would you be willing to withdraw your amendment and do a bill that we will look at all these fees and look at the disposition?
I'd be happy to do that, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Olson withdraws her amendment. I think the point has been made, Senator Higgins.
I'm going to move
what's your
bill.
Desire for the bill?
Madam Chair, I recommend that this, or I move that this bill be recommended to pass and go to the floor.
On Senator Higgins' motion, is there anybody in the audience who's here to speak either for or on behalf of for in opposition to this bill? Seeing none. Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 624, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators.
The next item on the agenda is Senator Olson, Senate File 323, Senator Olson. Senator Olson, is this your first bill?
It's my second, but throw me softballs, please.
You are now a professional. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
I'm Senator Olson, and I have Sheriff Sanders from Stearns County with me, and I can't even hardly see you down there. I didn't realize how far it was. But I appreciate coming before the committee today, and I would ask that the committee adopt our A2 Delete Everything Amendment to put the bill in a form that that I would prefer.
So moved.
At the author's request, Senator Higgins moved the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senator Olson, Senate File 323 as amended.
Okay, this is a bill on the theme of the day of fees. This bill fits right in there. What it's looking at as when a sheriff books a prisoner at the county board's discretion, they can charge, under current law, $10 for that booking fee. This bill would raise that fee to $25. There was some concerns that there's a number of people that can't afford a $25 fee, so you will see some changes in the bill that would address that. Number one, I guess it would be line 1.17, that unless a person qualifies financially for a public defender under the section, then that fee would be waived. And also, there was also concern about if somebody is found innocent, that there is a procedure for them to receive their booking money back. And so that's kind of the highlight of the bill. It's addressed some concerns from the sheriffs and from public defenders. And I would also turn it at this time if the sheriff has anything to speak to on the bill.
Sheriff Sander, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
John Sander. I'm the Stearns County Sheriff. Madam Chair, committee members, first of all, thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to address you this afternoon. Even though I am the Stearns County Sheriff, I am speaking in behalf of the entire Minnesota State Sheriffs Association when I testify today. And like the good senator to my left here, I was hopeful that you would have this entire fee issue resolved before we had to testify in this matter. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Sheriff. Are you finished with your comments?
No.
Please continue.
Thank you. Some of the references that I'll make for you will be specific to Stearns County simply because those are the numbers that I'm familiar with, and I can answer any questions that you might have in reference to the Stearns County numbers. But I'd like to start out by stating that the booking process itself costs approximately $25 to $75 to run the booking process through. And those numbers, we believe, are extremely conservative. Under current law, we're able to collect just $10 of that. So the county is absorbing a tremendous loss every time we book somebody in. And just to give you an example of the numbers I'm talking about, in 2006, Stearns County alone booked 7,940 inmates. Also, current law does not allow a booking fee to be levied against an inmate that's booked and released. It only addresses inmates that are booked and held. Stearns County, in 2006, booked and released 2,328 inmates that we had no opportunity to charge at all. One of the things that's happening here is that the burden is shifting from the defendant to the property taxes that are collected in the county. An example I'd like to give you is that if the victim lives in the county and is a taxpayer in the county, we actually re-victimize that person when we ask them again to pay for the booking fees for the offender that just burglarized his home. It doesn't really sound fair, does it? It doesn't to us. And we'd like to see that changed. We'd like to shift the burden to the defendant, to the person that's actually responsible for all of this process going forward, and not back to the property tax owners.
Sheriff Sander, can you walk us through the mechanics of how it happens under current law, what actually happens? At what point under current law do you then collect the fee? And then share with us a little bit, what if somebody doesn't have that fee, then what happens? So somebody gets picked up and they get brought into the station. What happens?
Okay, Madam Chair, if they're being booked into jail and it's not a book and release situation where we have an opportunity to collect the fee, if they have the money on them, we will collect it up front. If they have the ability to pay, we could possibly bill them and try to collect later. We lose approximately 20% of the ones that are actually billable for us. We write off about 20% for the people that simply don't have the money to pay or that promise payment, and we have to turn it over to a collection agency and we never do see the money. So about 20% of it we write off anyhow.
Sheriff, when somebody shows up to get booked, is there a decision that gets made whether there are somebody who's going to be kept or released?
That's normally up to either the arresting officer or the court.
So by that point, you already know who is going to get booked and released.
Most likely.
So under current law, the ones who are going to get booked and released don't even get asked to pay this fee.
That's correct.
And then now you're looking at the pool of people you've made the determination that are going to get booked. When you say if they can, we collect it up front, but if they can't afford, if they can afford it, if they don't have the money with them, we bill them. How do you make that determination?
I guess I'm sorry, I don't follow your question.
So somebody comes in and you made the determination that they're not going to get released.
Right.
At that point, you turn to them and say, what, the law allows us to collect
exactly a $10 booking fee.
And the person says, I got no money in my pocket.
A lot of times the money will come in to them. If they have money in an account, relatives, friends will bring money and establish an account so they can buy things from a canteen, small food items and things like that. If they develop the money over time, then we can take it out of that account.
Sheriff, and do you notify them that that when their money gets up to that point, you will take it from that account?
Yes, they're made aware of that.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sheriff, the way I'm reading this delete everything amendment, this money is collected by the sheriff for the county. Is that, or does it stay in the sheriff's account?
It stays within our budget to offset our operating costs.
And, Madam Chair, I have this letter from Chief of Police Tim Dolan, City of Minneapolis. And in this letter, it seems as though he's talking about wanting to keep as many officers on the street as possible. He's advocating to keep the processing, to raise the processing charge. But he doesn't collect this money, does he? Is this a financial benefit to his Minneapolis Police Department benefit?
Sheriff Sanders.
Or would it stay in the sheriff's account?
You know, I can't answer for Minneapolis and Hennepin County what system they operate under, but we don't charge a booking fee to the agencies that use the Stearns County Jail.
Okay. All right.
If that answers your question.
Madam Chair, Karen Lowry Wagner, City of Minneapolis. Senator Limmer, it's my understanding that within the City of Minneapolis, we actually pay Hennepin County a booking fee.
Ms. Wagner, how much is that booking fee?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I do not know that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I'm wondering if there might be a typo error in this letter.
I thought so, too.
Because in the first paragraph, it says that they're advocating to raise the fee, and in the second paragraph on the last sentence says any assistance in lowering these fees would be helpful. Am I missing something here?
Yeah, it took me a while to get to that too. Sorry, Madam Chairman. Because we have to pay the county a booking fee, I think the chief's thought was if the county is collecting more, then they won't charge the city as much for the booking fee that we're currently paying. If the county is allowed to collect an additional amount, that would be offset in what the city has to pay the county for booking fees.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you. One question that I had, and that was on process. I see that page 1, lines 19 through 20, talk upon a request of the person. I'm assuming that's the defendant that would not be, I guess not a defendant, a person not charged or someone who's acquitted, at the request of them through a form provided in paragraph A, how would they know that they can get their money back? Is it given in a form of a lettered form somewhere?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer.
Senator Olsen.
Under 1-9, it does say that the sheriff shall provide the person with a form summarizing the provisions of paragraph C, which is about that they can request a refund if they are not charged.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I just kind of find this, it's kind of like, for lack of a better term, it's kind of like rebates. You know, you go to a Menards store and your product qualifies for a rebate. But you only get the rebate if you send the rebate form in, wait your 6.5 weeks, and remember to do it after you've lost your receipt in the first place. And it's kind of a little bit of a misnomer, because I've talked to retailers about this, and they say, well, you know, 50% of the people never ask for the rebate anyway. But we can advertise it, and a lot of people buy that product. And I'm just wondering why, you know, I look at the power of the arrest, look at the power of the state. They're going to remove a person from the freedom to go around. You're taking that freedom away from them. You're holding them for a specific maybe an indeterminate amount of time. Then they can't make the case stick. And we're going to put the onus on them to seek a form, read the form, I'm assuming file the form, and then ask for the money to be given back to them if the money was taken from them, if they had cash in their pocket at the time of arrest. And I'm just wondering, why do we do that? Why don't we just, if the person's acquitted or not found guilty or released, just give him back his money?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, you found our secret plan on funding the new county jail systems. But unfortunately, no, I think you're right. That's kind of how it is. But I suspect from the prisoners in the county that I used to be a commissioner, they will not forget, and they will follow up to get that money back. I will say that one of the things that I'm carrying another bill for public safety that is going to require sheriffs to not only, now they're required to keep records of the prisoners that they arrest, but this will require them to also run the person's information through, I believe it's not the CRIMNET, but the Bureau of Criminal Apprehensions database, so that we're now, if this bill passes, which I'm hoping it will, this other bill is a safety issue bill, then we're putting another burden on local sheriff's departments to do more work for free, basically. So in my experience in county government, that, you know, we're being pinched everywhere along the way. This is a small token of trying to recoup some funds from some of the people that are actually causing these, you know, us to arrest people and put them in jail. In Chisago County, we have a system where if people qualify, we charge them $20 a day while they're incarcerated. So I think it's an effort to try to cut down on these, county government, just like state prisons, they don't know who's coming, who's going to break the laws, but these people come and they try to build budgets to you know, how many people they're going to have in jail, but it's a guess, and it's a best guess. And so this is just another tool to give them a little more money to cover some of those costs.
Madam Chair.
On this point, Senator Limmer?
Senator Olsen, the difference, though, between a prison and a jail is that the jail holds someone prior to conviction, and a prison will hold someone after the conviction is done. And so once the conviction, then the state does have the power to impose a fee, but on a guilty person. In this case, we're talking about someone who may be acquitted, meaning there wasn't enough evidence to convict, or they were released, or maybe there was extenuating circumstances that would negate the arrest itself. Maybe there wasn't enough evidence to make the case stick, but for some reason the person was brought into a jail.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that is correct. But I do not know the percentage, and maybe the sheriff knows the percentage of arrests they make that do stick, because counties are expending a lot of time to do these bookings, and I feel that the stress that counties are under financially, this is just a little bit of money to help them work through those.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, just to follow up on some comments that Senator, or the direction I think that Senator Limmer was going with his questioning, I have a real grave concern when we're placing a financial burden on someone who's not yet been convicted of a crime, and not just morally, but even legally. And I guess my first question, I know we just had some legislation that was going to require defendants to pay for a portion of their defense overturned. And I'm wondering first whether this initial $10 charge has ever been challenged in terms of whether we can actually charge someone when we've taken their freedom away from them involuntarily and they have yet to have been convicted of anything. So I guess I'm just wondering, you know, maybe someone knows the answer to that, but I'm wondering whether that's been challenged. I'm concerned about, again, why we wouldn't just give the money back to that person then if they were not appropriately detained, rather than making them file a form, because I was going to bring up the same point about the rebates. And I guess I'm also wondering why, if there's really a need for this money to support the county's sheriff's department, why that couldn't be imposed as a part of their sentence so that the money could go to them after the person has been convicted rather than being collected up front.
Sheriff Sander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of times that is happening where the sentence does indicate that part of that fee or the fee itself has to be payable that way. So that's happening right now, and I didn't mention that earlier. It just slipped my mind. And when I talked about some of the other money coming in with friends and family members, yeah, the court orders that that fee is to be paid in certain circumstances when there is some financial responsibility left there. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about the form that we referred to earlier and some of the reason that the form would be necessary instead of just simply handing the money back for these people is that we don't necessarily know when they're leaving the jail what the status is. It might not be a Stearns County case in our situation. It could easily be a City of St. Cloud case, and we wouldn't necessarily know that they were acquitted of that case until we use the form to gather that information. The county cases we most certainly would, but some of the city cases we might not. The senator also made reference to the fact that these people spending time in county jail are there pre-sentence, and they're not doing any of their sentence time in county jail. That's not true. A lot of people are sentenced to county jail on misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor offenses, some felony offenses. They don't ever leave the county jail. Some absolutely will leave and go to the Department of Corrections, state of Minnesota, but that's not the majority. The majority are staying in the county jail.
Sheriff Sander, how many counties in the state are collecting this booking fee?
I can't answer that. Don't know.
Okay, then can you tell us if there are counties that are not collecting any booking fees?
Absolutely. There are counties that do not have a county jail.
And then, Sheriff, of the original, so if we were to give you this $25, how do you justify the expense? What's the rationale? The fee and the services,
sure.
Do they fit? Can you talk about that a little
sure.
bit?
When I gave you an estimate earlier of $25 to $75, and I told you that estimate was extremely conservative, that's exactly what it is. It's very conservative. We have to pay staff's time to process. It takes approximately 20 minutes. If everything goes perfectly, it takes about 20 minutes to process a booking an individual. That's if the individual is, number one, cooperative, number two, not intoxicated, number three, doesn't have a vast majority of injuries to deal with for our nursing staff. There's so many factors that play into that. Probably a better estimate of conservatively what it costs us to book an inmate is probably closer to $50. But I wanted to give you very conservative numbers here just to let you know that the $25 isn't going to fix it for us. But it certainly is a step in the right direction to offset some of our costs here. But we've got a tremendous amount of costs, and like I mentioned earlier, the staff themselves. There's administrative costs that are incurred there. There are, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes nursing costs or medical costs. It just goes on and on.
And Sheriff, in line 1.22 to 1.27, you said the new language proposes that the chief executive officer of the local correctional facility or sheriff may waive the payment of a fee under this subdivision. How are we reassured that this waiver process is being applied equally all across the board?
I don't know how we could possibly assure you that it is, but I can tell you that we use it in Stearns County right now when somebody comes in and goes through the booking process, they have absolutely nothing on them. They have no ability to make any money. We will routinely waive that fee, and that's what this talks about.
And how do you know that, Sheriff? If somebody, I mean, if somebody absolutely has no money on them, how do you know that they don't have the ability to make that? Do they tell you that?
Sure. A lot of it is they're not members of the community. They're a transient population. They have not a penny on them when they're booked into jail. They have no means of income whatsoever. There's no reason for us to believe they'll ever have the money to pay the booking fee. So why in the world would we charge them? We don't. We waive the fee.
And then, Sheriff, do you then go back on this waiver if later on they have family members to actually come to visit them and start to deposit money into their candy account?
Yeah, I don't know that we have ever done that, but I can't say with certainty that we have not.
Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that I understand. I understand Chief Dolan's letter, I think, but I don't know if this is the if this is the portion of statute, I'm guessing not, that allows, that has them charging fees to the arresting jurisdiction, you know, to the city. So my cities of Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis must be paying a fee to Hennepin County, but it doesn't look like it's found here because this is about the person who's booked. So I'm wondering what kind of fees that they charge.
I'm wondering if is there somebody from the county association or from the, let's see, is Mr. Highland here?
Yes, he is.
Ms. Highland, can you answer that question?
I'm sorry, the question again, Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid. Madam Chair and Mr. Highland, where is the authority to charge arresting jurisdictions, and how much is that?
I'm going to have to defer to Mr. Backus on this one. I am not sure of the statute. Quite frankly, I'm not sure there is a statutory authority. I believe that is, from my recollection, my best recollection is that is a deal between the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office and the communities located within Hennepin County. I'm not certain that there is actually a statutory authority.
Mr. Tuma, are you in the audience?
Yes, I am.
Do you have information to
everybody's on this? Called out today.
Madam Chair, we have a citation.
We have a person.
All right, Mr. Highland.
It is
383B.
That's the authority for the sheriffs to charge.
That's what the wise people behind me are telling me.
Madam Chair. Ron Weiberg, Hennepin County. The statute is 383B, which is the Hennepin County statute. There are some specific statutes for Ramsey, Hennepin, Dakota, and Anoka, and they're all in the 383 series, 383 A, B, C, and D.
Could you spell your name?
W-I-B-O-R-G.
And it's Weiberg?
Yes.
Mr. Weiberg, how much how much is the booking fee that these different cities are paying to Hennepin County?
Madam Chair, that's a function of the Sheriff's Office, and I work for the Corrections Department, and it's two separate operations in Hennepin County. The Sheriff has the pretrial, and we have the post-conviction facility. And so the booking fee goes to the Sheriff's Office. I'm not sure how much it is, but let me check with some wise people behind me.
At some point, Senator Scheid, whether it is today or tomorrow, you'll get a response.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm advised the booking fee is $11.
And
so it's more than this.
So,
Senator Scheid.
So, Madam Chair, it strikes me then that Hennepin County might get $10 or $25 from the person and then more from the city. I mean, I understand the costs are higher than this. Oh, Mr. Weiberg is.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Weiberg.
The fee is charged to the municipality in Hennepin County, not to the person.
Then when it's reimbursed.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, maybe the Public Defender's Office might want to indicate their perspective on this thing.
Does the public defenders have a perspective on this issue? Now, members, I don't intend for this committee to become a circus, but I will come back to this issue because I think this is a very critical issue for us to think about.
Madam Chair, Robert Sikora, I work for the State Board of Public Defense. I'm arriving right at the moment you're describing a circus.
That won't be imputed onto you.
I'm happy. Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I'm here today just to observe, and it was not our intention to come forward with a position. We are concerned any time we see a fee being assessed without a hearing. Our thought is due process is about exactly that, process. And there is not a whole lot of process involved when a deputy sheriff is taking bills out of a detained person's wallet, a detained person that the Constitution presumes to be innocent.
Very well said. That's exactly the point that I wanted this committee to get to in our policy discussion. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I didn't even know there was a statute that allowed this prepayment. I was a public defender for 20 years. Maybe it's because down in my county they don't charge on it, but along your line and the two expressed over here, I would like to see this whole thing rewritten. I wouldn't mind paying $50 for the booking fee, but it should be ordered as part of the after the conviction. Under current law, you have to give it back if they're not charged, if it's dismissed, or if there's an acquittal. So under current law, you can only keep it if they're convicted anyway. There isn't any reason why we couldn't just make this a mandatory assessment, just like we do for the surcharges, and make it $50 if your class is $50. I don't care after they're convicted. Now, it would have to be waivable, I suppose, because there will be some people who are truly indigent, and I think we allow some of the surcharges to be waived too. But that's the way this statute should be written, it seems to me. So I mean, what I'd like to see is for Senator Olsen to work with his groups and come back with a rewritten proposal. It's too hard to rewrite it, but go for the $50 fee. I'd support that, but just get it after the fact.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Neville, I was thinking the same thing. Not quite 50, but an increase to compensate for the workload that the sheriffs have to go through. But with the idea of striking lines 9 through 11 and 19 through 20, that way and then add a dollar amount instead of the $25 on line 6, you could put in whatever dollar amount that the committee decides on, and we could resolve that now, or we could have the chief author come back to the committee if that's the wish of the chair. But how would you like to proceed?
Well, members, I think that this bill is before us. I think we need to have a discussion about the policy implication of this bill and address this bill that's in front of the committee. I think we need to give Senator Olsen the respect of either saying to him, it's good public policy, we're going to let you go, or we're going to say we don't think it's a good idea, and it rests here. But the next time, if you still want to address this, come back to us with a bill on a different issue. I think that's how we ought to proceed in the committee. But, you know, that's one person's thought. It's obviously the will of this committee. Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, to follow up the suggestion of Senator Limmer, my concern would be, as Senator Neville said, that still doesn't get at the issue of this being pre versus post conviction. And from a policy standpoint, echoing a little bit further what Senator Neville said, I am sympathetic to the counties having to bear these expenses. And I think I would welcome a bill along the lines of what Senator Neville suggested, but I'm very concerned about us starting to use the cost of the public defense or the justice system as someone pre-conviction having to pay those costs. We don't charge someone for the trial. We don't charge them as a matter of constitutional law for a fair defense. And so this is something that the counties have to bear. I understand the expense of incarcerating someone, but when it's pre-conviction, I don't believe we should be putting the cost of that process any more than we do for any of the other processes through the system on a person who has not yet been found guilty of a crime.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm still stuck on Hennepin County and Minneapolis and all the other Hennepin County jurisdictions. And I don't have any sense of how many people are booked but never charged, you know, and if my city's paying $2.5 million for these booking charges, you know, I'd like a little more information on whether...
Who gets the money?
Yeah.
Madam Chair?
I'm stuck. I'm Senator Olsey.
I need your help.
Totally incoherent.
I have pretty good ears, so I don't see you too well, but I'm hearing what you're saying. And I'm... Help me get out of this where I would like to take this back, rework it, and then come before the committee again with a reworked bill. So what procedure should I follow to do that?
Senator Olsen, there are two routes that we can help you. We can vote your bill down today, and that will allow you an opportunity to go back and work with your stakeholders on a different proposal to come back to us as a separate bill. You have to put that in fairly quickly, and I'd be willing to try to accommodate that deadline, you know, permitting. You could try to pass this, and I don't know if in the current state you can hear the conversation and you can count. So, but I'm not sure, or the other option is that we could lay the bill on the table and give you an opportunity to come back with, you know, yet another delete all amendment. I guess at this point my inclination is that if you at this point you risk the loss also of the $10 that's currently in here. I mean, it isn't just the additional money that you're going to get, but with the way the conversation is going around this table, you also risk the loss of that $10. And so those are the two routes. I mean, you've heard the concern. Senator Foley.
Not necessarily, because I think the matter should go to the Finance Committee. But I'd have to say that you can look at me and blame because I was the original author of this legislation.
I'm sympathetic,
but I want you to think back of what just happened up at Elk River. Where an individual was incarcerated because he didn't have insurance and a proof of insurance, and so he was put in with some, you know, a heavy duty guy, and was killed, and so what I'm saying is we need to look at who we are putting in the jail. The booking thing is a different sort of thing, and then by and large, I think the ejection shouldn't be there if you're number one taking a photo and number two taking fingerprints. The only caveat there would be that if you were acquitted, that you got those things were expunged from your record.
Senator Higgins,
two things: is anybody going to carry a bill to take away that right that you can be jailed for not having your insurance papers?
You should.
Second, I think I'll move to lay it on the table on behalf of Senator Olsen.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
We don't need a vote. Just do it.
All right, then we'll just Senator Olsen.
I'd like to say.
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, my name's Don Dame. I think I'm on the list to speak against this bill. May I do so?
Mr. Dame, you're more than welcome to speak against the bill. It looks like it's not going to pass out of the committee, but please go ahead.
We should Pete, I've heard, by the way, my name's Don Dame from Woodbury. I'm just an average citizen, mechanical engineer. I'm not a lawyer. I've heard the theoretical way things are supposed to work. I have firsthand experience. In the real world, it works exactly the opposite. I don't know what the procedure is here. I have some documents I'd like passed out to the...
We'll pass it out to the members.
And I have it... In what that document is, it's a receipt where I paid $30 to my son when he was in jail for the canteen, candy bars and stuff. They took all $30 and put it towards booking fees. He was booked once. On one violation, they charged him three booking fees. So I called to ask the jailer, why did this happen? And I have a tape recording of his response. And by the way, although I'm not a lawyer, you know, it's me paying the $30 to the jail, and I have a power of attorney from my son to speak, I guess, on his behalf, if the lawyers want to do lawyerly things and ask me, am I entitled to talk? So in any event, I would like to go through a couple of comments, and I'm talking basically about the receipt that you see where he was booked once for one crime, and he was charged three booking fees. But this foster son, by the way, that I have, has a mental impairment. In the way society has chosen to deal with people with mental impairments, they put them in jail. You know, that's a different argument, but that's what's going on. My concern today is that what can I as a citizen do when law enforcement officers violate the law? And this has been ongoing, and this is a good example. A uniformed sheriff deputy took my $30 that I gave to when I was visiting so he could use it for the canteen, and she put all of it towards three booking fees. And I asked the uniformed deputy, what law authorizes you to do what you're doing, taking my money away and putting it towards a booking fee? And I guess she was not uncivil, but she was indignant that I was questioning whether a uniformed deputy had the authority to do anything she wanted. She didn't know what law authorized to do it, and she said, of course what I'm doing is legal, implying that I have a uniform on, so it's legal if I do it. I found out later that it was not legal what she did. And the gist of it is this item in the law itself that says, if a person is not charged, is acquitted, or if the charges are dismissed, the sheriff shall return the fee to the person at the last known address. That never happened.
Mr. Dame, was your son acquitted?
It hasn't gone to trial yet. But he was charged three booking fees. He was charged with one violation. So I called the sheriff and said, why are you charging three booking fees? And I guess my son complained also that he didn't get the full $30. And the sheriff said, okay, since you've only been charged with one violation, instead of three booking fees, we'll only charge you two booking fees for the one violation. And then I complained about that, I believe, and that's what's on the tape recording, is the sheriff called me to explain why he's charging two booking fees. He doesn't say it's because of one violation, but that's true. But this is the real world. What happens, the way the sheriff deal with people who do have a problem. And I guess I should probably say my foster son is an Indian. And he's old enough where I know that minorities are not treated as well as Caucasians, in my opinion. Some people may question that. In addition to that, at the jail, when I was there, they had a brochure posted on the wall saying what to do if there are complaints. And I read the brochure, and since I hadn't been able to find out what the legal authority was for taking all $30 for one booking, I read the brochure from Washington County on the wall of the jail. So I went over to the jailer, and I said, can I have a copy of that brochure? They said, we don't have copies. They said, you have to call administration tomorrow. So I called the sheriff himself. I think his name is Bill Hutton. I called him personally, left a message saying, you know, why don't you have these complaint things available for people like me? And he said he would take care of it. And again, on the tape recording, you'll hear that the sheriff's deputy or the sergeant's response is that he's going to talk to somebody and make sure the brochures are there. Week or two later, I went back after the sheriff said he was going to have those brochures available. Not only did they not have brochures available for me to take home, but they had torn down the brochure off the wall. Just he wanted to prove to me that he was the boss, and if I complain about not having brochures, not only would I not get a brochure, but even the thing on the wall would be torn down. Also on the tape recording, you will hear that the sheriff has this familiar refrain that the legislature is passing so many laws that law enforcement people can't keep up with it, and it's not unreasonable for me to expect law enforcement people to obey the laws that you people pass because there's too many of them. So that's why the sheriff don't obey the laws. The same thing has happened in Roseville. A couple of years ago, I had a problem, and the Roseville city manager, who formerly was a city attorney, and he should know better, he sent me in writing a letter that said his bookshelves groan under the weight of laws passed by the legislature, and that it's unreasonable for me to think the city of Roseville can obey all of the laws that you people pass. I guess it's an ongoing thing. A related type thing, to show the type of problems I'm having, during a previous jailing, and by the way, my son's been jailed a number of times. He steals cars, and he gets jailed for it. And I'm not questioning that.
He's not good.
But during a previous jailing, he had a bunch of personal belongings, like a wallet and a driver's license. The jailer put everything in a paper bag and gave him a receipt for one paper bag of stuff. And a few days later, he was released from jail, and they gave him a paper bag of stuff back. And my son signed a receipt saying, "I received a paper bag with some stuff in it." When he got home, he found his wallet was missing and his driver's license was missing. And a few days after that, some woman called, left a message on her answering machine that she was released from jail, and in her paper bag was my son's wallet and driver's license. But the woman never left a phone number or name. We had no way to contact her. So I called the jail. This was about a year ago. I said, "Can you check your records to find out where's my son's wallet and driver's license that you never returned in the bag?"
Mr. Dame?
Yes.
I very much want to accommodate the public's coming to participate in the committee. But what I would like is if you could proceed with the testimony that you have with respect to this bill so that the committee can make our decision without straying to, other areas that are not permanent, as interesting as it is.
Okay.
And I don't want to be unfriendly to you.
That's fine.
To accommodate you. So please come back to the testimony that's pertinent to this bill.
I will play the tape recording from the Washington County Sheriff Deputy when I question him on several of these things. Like, why was he being charged several booking fees for one booking? What I'm really leading up to is I don't think you, the committee, should reward the law enforcement people for their misconduct. Do not increase the fee. Well, let me play you the tape recording.
And how long is it?
Mr. Dame, Sergeant Hyatt, Washington County Sheriff's Office, 430-7912. If you want to give me a call back, got some information on, is it your son? Moses, Jeremiah? As far as his money, I can certainly talk to our secretaries about maybe some of the communication issues you might have had with them and attitude. But actually, what happened was your son came in a couple times, and he came in on January 8th of 06 on a warrant. Didn't have any money, so obviously he was charged a booking fee of $10, which is what we would do. It wasn't a writ. It was actually a warrant. Then he came in on this latest time, which is 117. Again, came in, turned himself in, and owed us $10 because he didn't have any money on him. So now we're up to $20 on booking fees. And then he bought some canteen on the 22nd, which is today, and that was a total of $8.85. And so when you add that up, it's $28.85. And then you take the $30 you dropped off, and we subtract the booking fees plus the canteen he ordered, he's down to $1.15. So that total in his possessions, which is actually private data, but since you brought it up, and I'm assuming Jeremiah must have called you, that total is correct. And it's unfortunate. I understand maybe you're upset when people drop off money and then the booking fees get deducted and they can't order the canteen that they wanted to, but that's the policy we have, and we have the same policy as any other jail, there when they owe money through engine supplies, through booking fees, whatever new monies they have come in, all that gets deducted off the top. And then the rest they have to order Cheetos and fruits and whatever else they want to order. So it's not a great system that the inmates like, but it's a system that the public would demand because we have fees, the fees go to the county, and they use that in all the budgeting, all the things that they do. So long story short is actually the money he has in his account right now is correct. I verified it myself, and so he should be good to go. And then I'll also look into talking to the secretaries you might have dealt with that you might have had issue with, and I'll try to get back to you tomorrow or the next day on that. Thank you very much. Bye.
Tuesday, 9:28 a.m., line 1.
And Mr. Dame Roger Heinen, Washington County Sheriff's again. Got your message. It looks like you got mine. Just a couple of points, hopefully, to clarify. The statute number that you want to look up is 641.12, subdivision 1. And you can look that up on the Internet. That's actually a form, and the statute number is on all the booking fees we give the inmates when they get booked in. So your son the last few years, every time he's come in, he signed a form that basically explained why a booking fee is taken from him. So he's actually known this for probably a few years. But irregardless, that's what it is, 641.12. It gives the county board the authority to book each person and to take a fee. As a matter of fact, I think the county board is actually looking at raising that sometime in the future. So $10 is probably the cheapest it's ever going to be at this point. So your son knows that's what the statute is, and hopefully you can look that up and research that yourself a little bit. And then again, our rules and our policy and procedures are very specific. It doesn't matter if a person reports, turns themselves in. Doesn't matter. When they come in, with very few exceptions, they have to pay a booking fee. You know, again, whether they're arrested on a new charge, a warrant, turn themselves in, you know, reported, they're all going to pay a booking fee. That's what our rules and regulations have been approved by the county board. And so, again, your son's account is fine. The money he has in there, which is like $1.15, that's deducted from the two booking fees he owes plus the canteen he ordered, and that's why he has that. So that I can't change that. That the money he has in his account is correct. As far as the posting of the complaints, that actually is posted on a window outside the jail lobby. We'll talk about that tomorrow at one of our meetings. We'll get some more of those complaint forms and master control. Well, we used to have some, so we ran out. So I apologize for that, but we'll get some more forms in there so when citizens come in and they want to make a complaint, they actually have a form that they can use. So that will be dealt with also. And then as far as, you know, when you drop off money, as you probably realize, we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of laws and rules and ordinances we have to follow, and there's really no way we can have a printed, you know, copy of every law and ordinance printed for every question the public may have. The best answer we can give people if we don't know it is we'll get back to you, and or here's the resource you can look at to find it. But there's to have the expectation that when you ask for something, we're going to have something written down to hand out to people on a particular statute. And I think that's unreasonable. You know, what is reasonable is for the inmates to know where their money's going, and we have provided that for them. So hopefully that has answered all your questions. I'm not sure you're going to like my answers, but hopefully it answered all your questions for you. Again, you can call me back. If this does not satisfy you, you can certainly call the jail administrator at 651-430-7606. I'm not sure you're going to get any different answer than I gave you because we're just following the rules and the laws and the chapters and all that good stuff, but you are certainly welcome to ask more questions if you so desire. Thank you. Bye.
He still ended up charging two booking fees for one violation. The law, the way it exists now, is the sheriff was supposed to return the money. This is prior to this filling out Form A, and the sheriff never returned the money.
Thank you, Mr. Dame. Your information has been very, very helpful, and it does add meat to the discussion that we've been having up to this point. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, if Senator Higgins would, did you have a motion to lay it on the table?
I guess I did.
If she'd be willing to withdraw that, I had something that I just passed out that I think capsulizes at least some of the discussions here, and I'd like to offer that as a delete everything amendment. And I think it's been given to Senator Olstein, and just at least to get his reaction to it, see if we're going in the right direction. But what this amendment is it would just make it mandatory that there be a $45 fine. It's collected on conviction, which is consistent with current law, and it makes a waiver for people who qualify for public defense, which is in your amendment already. So I think that philosophically this is a better way to collect the fee. I'm sensitive to the fact counties shouldn't be asking property taxpayers to pay if the actual cost is 50 to 70. You should be getting more than 10 bucks. So this tries to accomplish your goal of getting more money. It tries to accomplish the due process of getting it after the fact, and it accomplishes a waiver for indigent people. So I'm wondering if this would be consistent with where you'd like to go.
Senator Olstein.
Madam Chair and Senator, I feel that after hearing the discussion among the committee that this is kind of making lemonade out of lemon, so I appreciate that. I think it addresses the concerns I heard around the table and actually gives the county more money in the long run anyhow. So it does sound like it's very acceptable.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that Senator Neville is following a long path that we've used in the past. The only question is that to get something this quick, I really think that we should lay this over to request that they come in on the next and use that as a base for.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, maybe that's not a bad idea. I would like a little more information. What percentage of people are booked and never charged? And what I'm trying to get at is if the jails are now getting $10 for everybody who comes in, but if only one of five people is actually ever charged and they're going to get $50 or $45, our jails will be getting less money than what they were. Now, if they are, if 20%, okay, they're getting some more money, which I think was the point of the whole thing. So I think what we need to do is find out kind of what percentage of people who are booked are never charged, so we have a sense of whether we're helping or harming.
Well, Senator Higgins, I don't think you're going to be able to find that answer because I think it would vary county by county, and unless there's an entity out there that has that information aggregated somewhere, I don't think that we would have that information. Senator Olstein.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, under line 1.5, where it had been crossed out, under the existing law, the county would not collect the money unless there, because it says, and not released upon completion of the booking process. So then if somebody's booked and held, then they could charge the fee. But if they were released, then they weren't charged the fee.
And if they were acquitted,
then they get the money back.
They get the
money. Madam Chair, if I may.
Sheriff Sanders.
But aren't there people, Madam Chair, who are charged with a crime who are not held after they've been booked?
Senator Higgins,
don't we kind of have a catch and release at some point?
We call it book and release.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
Sheriff Sanders.
It was a fishing thing.
I'd like to point out the fact that sometimes when these defendants come into jail and originally go through the booking process, they have a tremendous amount of cash on their person. But somehow, down through the system, they end up qualifying for a public defender and have absolutely no money later on. Sure. That also happens.
Well, Sheriff Sanders, I agree that might be the reality, but I think what's in the purview of this committee is the due process issue. I do have some serious concerns that we are making people pay for their booking up front. I know that I will probably hear from my county, but part of the public safety service that we provide and part of the money that we provide with our tax dollars is for those for the management of our jails, and we build a budget on how we manage that. And we build that into the levies that we put into place that we ask citizens to pay for as part of the overall package. So while I'm sympathetic that this that your costs have gone up, I think that philosophically it doesn't sit right with me that we're making people, just because they happen to get picked up, pay for the cost of booking them when that is part of the larger society cost that we all choose to consent to as people who live in a community. And I think that the direction that, that we need to go and this committee is going is I need to bring us back to the earlier discussion that we have, which is from a policy standpoint, do we agree that we would have people without having gone through the due process pay to get their fingers printed and to get put in jail, whether they've been convicted as being guilty or not? And what I'm hearing from this committee is that I don't think that from a public policy discussion that we agree with that. That there's some fundamental value to people being innocent until they've been convicted guilty before we pay the penalty. And I think that Senator Neville's suggestion is a very good suggestion, which keeps us on the route to protecting the due process for the individuals to get brought in. But if in that process they are convicted, then the counties can go after them for this fee. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on a very practical level, I think, and echo what you're saying, I think what we're doing right now with this system is we are leveraging someone's desire to allow an innocent person while they're waiting for their trial to have a few small comforts that family must first come up with, you know, a 10 and under the way the law is proposed, a $25 fee. No matter how poor that person or that family may be, while they are still presumed to be innocent, to be able to have a pop or to have anything at all during that time, they first got to pay this fee. And I just fundamentally disagree with that.
Well, members, let's do this. Senator Neville, do you want to move this amendment?
I would. And if the author is comfortable with it, I'll move it. And the only thing, I guess, caveat I'd have to put on this is that there should also be an understanding that it would be the Senate Council would it be at liberty to fit it in properly, because I think we have to delete subdivision C, and I didn't write that down. But this is intended to be an entire replacement of 64112 subdivision 1.
Madam Chair?
Senator Betson.
I don't know if Council's had a chance to review it and so forth and see if there's any thoughts. I mean, we probably need an effective date. Does July – I mean, it would normally be effective August 1st, but budget issues are usually effective July 1st. I don't know whether there's a difference here.
Mr. Backus, is that do we have a sufficient effective date?
Madam Chair and members, I think the intent of Senator Neville, as he stated, is to basically take this language and substitute it for the current subdivision 1. So I would interpret that to keep the same effective date that's on line 1.27. At least that's how I would engross it, so to speak.
Senator Betzel.
Sure. Another thing, and you keep trying to read the language and looking for the loopholes that people would find, and the jail shall pay a booking fee, well, the person should pay a booking fee of $45. And I interpret that to be one fee, you know, listening to what Mr. Dame said. But then upon conviction of the offense, so would anybody creatively say, well, this person was convicted of multiple offenses, therefore I get to charge multiple fees? I wouldn't read it that way, but somebody might say, well, you know, you have a singular offense, singular fee, multiple offense equals multiple fees.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
I thought the impression I got from the tape and from the sheriff was that if you charge with multiple offenses, don't you pay a multiple booking fee now? Or is it just one?
Yeah.
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Sheriff Santa.
You pay one fee if you're charged with multiple counts?
I don't know for sure, but I don't believe we charge multiple booking fees. I think it's a one-time fee in Stearns County.
Well,
as I'm sitting here participating in this discussion and so forth, I mean, I would read it to be just one fee regardless of the number of the offenses, but again, I'm not I don't know who creative people are out there looking at this and trying to find a way to enhance the revenues.
I tried to mirror the language that's in the current statute, so I'm not intending to change that. If the practice is one booking fee and you get multiple counts, that's the way it should be, I think.
Yes.
You've only taken one set of pictures and fingerprints.
Right.
So that's the way it should be. I don't have an intent to change that.
One last question.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Neville, what? Would you be intending that your amendment language would also replace paragraph D?
Yes.
And the effective date you'd leave in.
Leave in. This would be total substitute language for subdivision one. So there would be no C or D.
I believe that in the members, why don't we, in each person who is booked for confinement at a county or a regional jail shall pay one, take out the word A and just put in the word one booking fee. And I think that should take care of Senator Betzel's loophole. I'm ready to move on this amendment unless there's any further discussion. Senator Olson, did you?
Nothing further, Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm concerned about moving into this right away. I'm still interested in finding out what the city of Minneapolis and how they were obligated to pay $2.5 million or whatever it was.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
I think Mr. Backus had some information on that.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, members, from discussions with Mr. Weiberg and others, as far as we can tell, that's most likely the agreement between the county and the local units of government. We haven't been able to find anything in statute that would require that.
So they've just done it to themselves.
Sheriff Sanner.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd like to make a brief comment based on the testimony that we heard this afternoon, if that's okay.
From the gentleman and, Sheriff, I think that we've had plenty of discussion. The gentleman has added some, food for thought on the table. I think we're ready to to move on this bill. Thank you. Thank you. On Senator Neville's amendment, with the changes and with the understanding that Senate counsel will have the opportunity to make this a delete all and with an effective date and fit it into the language of the bill, taking into consideration the conversations at the table. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Now, on Senate file 323, as amended, Senator Higgins moved that Senate file 323 as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. Any discussions on Senate file 323 as amended? Seeing none.
Madam Chair, sometimes if it has a local impact, sometimes we want the Finance Committee to look at it. I don't know if this has a local impact. We're changing. So, maybe, I don't know if Council has any thoughts on that. I don't know.
Mr. Backus, do you have any thoughts on that? Or Mr. Turner?
Mr. Turner, probably, yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, it's up to Senator Higgins if she wants to.
Oh, it's your budget division.
Yeah, that would be my division, yeah. Would it be your budget division?
No, it would be Leo's.
Well, Senator Higgins and Senator Foley, I don't think this has an impact on your budget. It has a local impact the way Senator Betzel's bill had a local impact on his county. And that went to the floor.
So, Madam Chair, if we send it to somebody's division,
right, yeah.
Would we get a local impact statement or local fiscal note or something?
I don't.
The only reason to do it, but if we don't get one, then
Senator Higgins, I don't think that's the case. When there's a local impact, in the instance of Senator Betzel's bill earlier, when we raised the fee that went purely to the county, it went directly to the floor.
Right.
In this instance, I don't think that it. I mean, it's certainly the prerogative of this committee, and if you would like it, we can send to full finance, but I don't think it needs to go to full finance.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I agree that I don't think it needs to go to finance, but I would say it's possible that I suppose that the counties could say they will realize less this way. I don't know, because of the people that don't get a refund or, whatever. I don't know, because the law, current law says they're supposed to send it. I have no idea if that's happening, but I'm not terribly concerned. They'll tell us, I think, if they have a problem.
Senator Neville.
And Madam Chair, in response to that, though, their bill was already making the exception for the ones represented by public defense. So that was already in it. The only way they would reap less is if people are acquitted who aren't coming back to get their rebate. And that's where the due process is. So I tried to factor – they were only asking for $25. I'm trying to factor that in by giving them $45. They should be so thankful that I'm willing to offer an amendment at $45. But they're shaking their heads no. I mean, frankly, if they oppose this, they should say so now.
Madam Chair, I was trying very hard not to come up here. My name is John Tuma. I'm with the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and the reason why, Your Honor, would be that the judges are not going to order this to be paid, and that's the experience we have, is that a lot of the judges have been fed to death over the last 4 years, and they're not ordering these fees, whether we like to think they're mandatory or not. The reality, once we get to this point, we're going to find probably maybe 1/6 to 1/8 of these people are going to be paying that actual fee. And when you do the math, we're going to be probably getting less money. Now, do I know that for sure? No, I don't. And so that one of the first things I will do once this bill passes out here is ask some of our county attorneys to give us an assessment of what they think would happen. Again, the reason this was passed, because Dakota County came to us and they were getting tired of seeing people go by their facilities with big rolls of cash and end up with public defenders in a matter of a couple of months. And so the bottom line was this was the most sensible way for them to see collecting this fee. If the person is innocent, they have every due process of getting their money back by asking for it. And I think, as you heard the tape, the sheriffs are not being difficult. Sheriffs are trying to do their job. They're elected officials in a difficult position, and they're trying to run a facility when they're running out of money. In a morbid way, this kind of helps us out, I think, when we get to Senator Olsen's bill on short-term offenders, to make the point that these facilities have been taking on a lot of state responsibilities and not getting sufficient funds to cover them. So we appreciate your time, Madam Chair.
Well, Mr. Tuma, a big wad of cash envy does not negate our responsibility to look at the due process issue that's involved here.
You are absolutely right, Madam Chair, and I think you hit the nail on the head. Is there due process? We feel that the things we put into this bill, the changes we made over the existing law, okay, allowing there to be a clear explanation, a form given to the individual, explaining their rights and the right to get their money back, is far better than the existing system. And so we thought we were accommodating the public defenders. We have been open and upfront with them throughout this process, explaining to them the changes. They certainly indicated they'd have, some concerns with the overall concept. My conversations with the public defenders so far is they were very thankful with the changes that we were making to the existing law. Understand that the additional provisions that are in there, the underlines, are additional rights given to the defendants so that they can have an opportunity to have the fee waived or get the money back in a timely and a fair manner. And so I think the sheriffs are doing their job to respect the due process of these individuals. The bottom line is, though, we have to try to manage these facilities, and it costs more to book people now. CrimNet is going to cost a significant amount of local time to book individuals according to the new processes, and that's a state mandate to try to make public safety happen. And we're happy to participate in that, but we need to recognize that there's a cost there, and it's either going to be your property taxpayers that pay it, or it's going to be the criminals. We think the criminals should be a participant in that process.
Mr. Tuma, these people have not been convicted yet. And I think that in this discussion today, just because someone is brought in and booked, we should not presume that we ought to penalize them up front. And so, I think that's in the tone of the discussion, just because someone gets picked up and brought in, and they haven't gone through the process and have not been convicted, we should not already have stigmatized them that they ought to be paying a penalty up front.
And if you
and
can,
that's part of the cost that we incur as a society to address the issue. So I'm ready to move on the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
This public defender applies only to people who have no fund.
It's been adopted. I'm ready to move on the bill. On Senate file 323 as amended, As moved by Senator Higgins. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion passes. Senator Higgins?
Yes, that's true.
If the person has no finger.
Senator Higgins,
see,
I understand that one of your people who is here to testify may have a time constraint. Is your person able to stay, or should we reschedule this for another day when that person can still be here?
Mr. Chair, I believe if Mr. Thompson is the person, he has to get his children by 6:30. So, depending on how far away they are.
We'll try to accommodate you.
It's 40 minutes away. We can be done by then. And get him out of here quickly. Yep.
Senate Bill 675.
Madam Chair, I'd like to start with the A1 author's amendment, and it is just technical.
On the A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, this is Senate File 675. During the 2006 legislative session, the judicial branch pursued a cleanup bill to remove obsolete references and provisions. And then that bill was added to an omnibus bill, but there was an incorrect repealer in the omnibus bill, and it led to the unintentional repeal of a 1963 law unique to Hennepin County. The repealed law required Hennepin County District Court to disburse non-felony forfeited bail to the municipality in which the offense occurred. But since July 1st of last year, these bail proceeds have mistakenly been credited to the state's general fund. A companion to 1963 law that wasn't appealed requires the municipalities in Hennepin County to pay the county workhouse for the incarceration of misdemeanants. The bail proceeds were intended to help municipalities pay for these incarceration costs. And so this bill, which is the solution, would restore the repealed 1963 law and reclaim the funds that never should have gone to the general fund in the first place. For most of fiscal year 2007, that's about $200,000 that would reimburse the municipalities for the bail proceeds not received. For the end of fiscal year 2007 and fiscal years 2008 and 9, this would redirect future bail proceeds back where we believe they should be, to the municipalities and not the general fund. This does not affect the budget of Hennepin County District Court because this is only a pass-through for the bail proceeds. And I have testifying with me to my left, Mark Thompson, the Judicial Court Administrator for Hennepin County, and he's not here, but Ron Weiborg, who we heard from earlier from Hennepin County Department of Community Corrections, and Ken Bergstrom from Hennepin County District Court will be able to help answer questions.
Welcome to the meeting, Mr. Thompson.
Good day, Madam Chair.
Do you have some comments to make,
yeah,
or are you just
I would
here to
say,
answer questions?
In previous discussions here today, you heard about the unique relationships regarding Hennepin County booking fees and workhouse fees. And I will tell you that Hennepin is the only county in the state of Minnesota where the – I'll give you the history on this so you understand the larger issue. Hennepin County's workhouse was actually owned by the city of Minneapolis. In 1963, an agreement was made with various prescriptions, such as the one you have before you right now, which offset the costs of the city then having to pay and the municipalities then having to pay workhouse fees or jail fees for misdemeanants on an overnight basis. There isn't another municipality outside of Hennepin County that pays for misdemeanor defendants to go to jail overnight. The municipalities and the city of Minneapolis all pay that fee for misdemeanors in Hennepin County. That's one of the offsets of that fee in 1963 was contemplated and has been ever since, with the exception of the repeal that occurred errantly last year, was this about $250,000 annually, which is a bail forfeiture amount, which I sign off in the forfeiture. That money then gets dispersed to the municipality where the crime occurred.
Mr. Johnson, can you describe the circumstances under which a bail abandonment would happen?
When a person fails to appear before their appearance in a criminal matter in court, particularly Hennepin County District Court in this instance, and we've tried to notify them they don't appear, the judge orders the bail to be collected. forfeited, if you will.
And if the repeal had not taken place, where would that money then go?
Had it not taken place, it would have gone where it had gone for the last 44 years, which is to the municipalities that prosecute wherever the person's crime occurred.
And I understand that there's a companion law that requires the payment, that there was a companion law that requires the municipality to pay for the incarcerations. That, is that still in books?
That is correct. The agreement, when the workhouse transferred from the city of Minneapolis for the consideration of a dollar to Hennepin County so that Hennepin County would then run and operate it in 1963, this was one of the quid pro quos, that there would actually be misdemeanor costs charged to the cities for them to put misdemeanor defendants, not felonies and not gross misdemeanors, but only misdemeanor defendants in the Hennepin County workhouse. So if the dear city of Minnetonka decides that on a DWI 0.17, this is an egregious offense, we're going to give this person one day in jail, the judge sentences them to one day in jail, the city of Minnetonka is then billed for that day in jail by the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department. Actually, it's the Hennepin County Community Corrections Department. Annual revenues for this on the Community Corrections Department, who runs the workhouse, are about $1 million a year.
Mr. Thompson, in other counties, when there's a bail abandonment, what happens to that money?
That bail is forfeited to the State General Revenue Fund.
To the State General Fund. So, Mr. Thompson, is this an even swap, or does somebody make out with a little bit of flush?
Yeah, but it's not an even swap, but there's a series of agreements that preceded me that were done by well-meaning people, probably in this room and others in this building, that were the quid pro quos for transferring the cost of operating the jail from the city of Minneapolis and the suburbs, who then helped pay for that, to Hennepin County, so that both the city of Minneapolis and the suburbs would offset some of those incarceration costs.
Okay. And members, you have a chart in your folder that says, I believe, that these are actual figures for the first 6 months of FY 2007. That amount is about 123.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
So I'm assuming that they probably get to about 200-300.
About.
Any questions? Any more questions for Senator Higgins? Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, on line 2.11, I'm not sure I've ever seen a bill say "and estimated to be 200,000. I mean, it should either be just delete that, or we should say "not to exceed 200,000" or something like that. But I'm not sure what "estimated" means. It could be higher or lower, so we don't need it at all, frankly.
Mr. Backus.
Yeah. Madam Chair and members, I think it's, again, just to give you an estimate of what it's likely to be, you know, just in case you want to know that. It's not substantive.
Yeah. But, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
To the witness, would it be sufficient just to say not to exceed 200,000?
I think.
Or should we just
Mr.
delete
Thompson.
It?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I think that we had projected out of my budget as we went through every one of these that it would be around 250,000 annually. So if we were going to put a not to exceed in, I would ask that you put it at that level.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel.
This is an appropriation. This clearly has to go to the Finance Committee then, because we're appropriating money, and Finance is not going to let it out with this kind of language. They're just going
right.
to say, here's the number, and since we can't guess what it is, maybe we should just send it to the Finance Committee and they'll right. insert the proper number, whatever it is.
Well, you know, Senator Betzel, while I agree with you that if something is a bad policy idea, the money piece shouldn't matter, but in this case, I think the question at issue here is the money piece. So, Senator Foley, I think this may be coming to you, or is it going to Senator
Welcome
Higgins? I'm not
goes
sure.
goes to finance in any it's case. Yeah. You send it there, so, and then they'll send it to you.
Any other points of discussion on the bill? Senator Higgins, what's your desire with this bill?
Madam Chair, I move that this bill be recommended to pass and be re-referred to finance.
Did you amend it?
As amended.
Is there anybody in the audience who's here to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Higgins removes her motion that Senate File 675, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Let the record reflect that we've been operating under a quorum from the very beginning of the meeting. The committee is adjourned.